in the value of reality. And no other value had any meaning for him. I can remember many times in my life Shoghi Effendi saying that he hated ambition. And there are some words of Abdu'l-Bahá saying, "Ambition is an abomination before the Lord." Well, that's pretty strong language. Now, I don't think that this meant ambition in the sense of a normal desire to do your work properly, to carry on your affairs as you should in service to the cause of God. I don't think it meant anything like that, to excel, for instance, in whatever your profession was or your specialty was. I don't think it was in that sense of ambition. But ambition, which we all know has a very unpleasant connotation, you know, get out of my way, I'm headed for the top sort of thing, or who are you, or I'm the one that's important. In this sense of ambition, Shoghi Effendi literally hated it, and he couldn't stand ambitious people. And if somebody turned up that had this characteristic, it was with difficulty that he could control his aversion to it. It was so strong in the Guardian. He considered it a perfectly horrible human characteristic. And I don't know why we shouldn't know that. It happens to be true, you see. No reason why we should be blind to such things. We have had over and over again examples in the cause of God of how the little people have risen up in the faith and been of tremendous value in serving. For instance, one of the Baha'i poets, the Persians here will remember him, Salman, the barber of Baha'u'llah, who used to carry his letters back and forth on foot, his postman, walk 4 months to Persia and go around delivering the mail and getting hold of some more letters and addressed to Baha'u'llah, walk 4 months back to the Holy Land and deliver them to Baha'u'llah and take the mail back again and so on, you see. And he wrote the most, he was illiterate, but he wrote the most beautiful poems. I see there's some writing of Fazi there. And some of my happiest and dearest recollections in my life in Haifa after the passing of the Guardian, the Days of the Hands, was sitting on the balcony in the moonlight with Mrs. Collins and Fazi and I think Ethel Revelle and Alice Kidders, I remember. Anyway, Fazi, who had this beautiful velvety voice, as you know, would chant for us poems, and one of them was often one of the poems of Salman. We have so many examples in the Baha'i faith, you see, of how little people with no social standing, no money, and no education have risen to such tremendous heights. Take, for instance, the praise of Baha'u'llah, the sifter of wheat. What a high station he attained. He was sitting in the market in Isfahan sifting wheat, getting the chaff out of it. Well, that's scarcely a very highly educated profession. And then he decided he'd go and be martyred. So off he went to join the others and got martyred. And as Baha'u'llah said, none of the divines of Isfahan responded to my message, but he did. We have one of the descendants of that family. They're very proud of that name, Gandom Pakkun. Sifters of wheat, they bear the name as a family name. We have one of them serving the House of Justice as one of the secretaries in Haifa right now, you see. So my point is that whatever we do as Baha'is, whatever line we take in life, let us get our values clearly fixed in our minds. I'm not saying that a professor shouldn't be a professor, but should go out and be a sifter of wheat in a village somewhere, or that a peasant must come and be elected to a national spiritual assembly or give a talk, for instance, to some non-Baha'i institution or something like that. That's not the point. The point is what goes on in our minds as the kind of Baha'is we are in this room in relationship to a lot of other Baha'is of a different category. And I think that we've simply got to understand this. Now, I like to, I'm no mathematician. In fact, I'm a congenital idiot mathematically, and it's one reason that I can prove I'm legitimate, because my father and my mother, neither of them had any mathematical sense, and I have even less. But I do know that if, say, after the lapse of 1,000 years or whatever it's going to be, we have another manifestation of God and a new dispensation, and this one's already run 138, you tell me how we're going to get the human race into the cause of God if that's what we're supposed to do. You can't establish the order of Baha'u'llah as a working proposition unless you have vast masses of human beings, because it presupposes vast masses. You simply cannot do it under any other basis, because although there are loads of teachings about character in the faith and individual redemption, it's absolutely useless to think you're going to establish the social teachings of Baha'u'llah, which are coming in the fullness of time, build up the Baha'i administration, which is supposed to evolve into the world order of Baha'u'llah, without millions and millions of people, because it's the only way you can implement it. You can't possibly implement it with a small number of people. As I always say, you can't make flour with a little bit of flour in the palm of your hand, a couple of drops of water, and a pinch of salt. You can't make bread that way. Try it. Every woman knows if you want to make bread, you got to have a big basin of flour, quite a lot of water, and the salt, and then you have to knead it. And you can't knead a small quantity. You have to only can knead a big quantity, you see. So this is what we're up against with the teachings of Baha'u'llah. They're going to save the world. They're going to change the whole planet. They're going to bring in what he said, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, and so on. And yet, how are you going to do it if you don't have the masses? And how are you going to get the masses into the faith if you think they've got to have some kind of a college education first, or they've got to have some kind of a Baha'i education first? Where is that in the teachings? The 20,000 Baha'is that were martyred in Persia, Shoghi Effendi said that we were the children, the spiritual descendants of the dawnbreakers. That's in his writing. All right, what were they? They were literates. You think they were all Hujjats and Vahids? Of course not. They were the minority, tiny, tiny bunch of mullahs up at the top of the ladder. It was the illiterate Persian villager that's our spiritual ancestors, not the educated ones. So that it doesn't hold, you see. We have got to get, I couldn't possibly say it more from my heart. We have got to get our values sorted out, and we've got to get things in focus if we want to establish the cause of God or even begin to do it. And we're not going to do it unless we think, I think, along these lines. Now, what we do about it's another matter, you see. But at least let's get it sorted out in our heads. Because a great many Baha'is either haven't got it sorted out or refuse to sort it out, because, frankly, they're too prejudiced. They're too conceited about their Persian ancestors or their degree or whatever it is. And then who are these people? How could they be Baha'is when I'm a Baha'i? You see, that's perfectly ridiculous, because from these people we're going to get our leaders. I remember Rufino, whom I absolutely adore. He also happens to be an Ecuadorian Indian, about that high. Some of you met him probably. And God bless him. I don't know how many thousands of people he's brought into the faith. So the last time that I ran across him in Ecuador, he'd been on a teaching trip with maybe other people in that area in the mountains, and they had brought in 2,000 new Baha'is. And then when they got all of these registrations home, they found that, I don't know, a very high percentage was false names. Well, I was appalled, you see. My background and my passion for accuracy and facts, you see, and my whole civilization and everything and training, my God, this was terrible. I was petrified. I said, what are you going to do? That's terrible, you see. And, of course, they're afraid of taxes and afraid of things that are going to happen to them because they're so downtrodden that they think if somebody comes and takes any kind of a census, you see, anything they have to give a correct name, they're scared to death. You would be, too, if you were one of them. So they gave false names, accepted the faith. That was fine. They were happy to become Baha'is, but they wouldn't give their correct name. Well, I said, what are you going to do? She said, we will go back and win their confidence, and then slowly we will change the name on the list so that we get the correct name. Just as cool as a cucumber. Well, that to me is the way to teach. That's marvelous. You know, in this connection somebody will have to turn me off because when I get on this subject, it's very difficult to shut me up. I think that we greatly underestimate intelligence. And it's not a subject for this particular moment or conference, but I believe that all down the line in nature, we greatly underestimate intelligence. I don't mean gray matter, because we know all about, you know, the weight of the brain and Cro-Magnon, and now we've got a better brain, Homo sapiens, sap particularly. But whatever it is, we don't realize that intelligence is a profound characteristic of nature. And I believe that even bugs are intelligent. I don't know about amoebas. I won't go that far. Maybe the one that's attacking me at the moment's intelligent too. But the point is that personality and a relative degree of intelligence can go right straight down even to the level of insects. And I am absolutely sure of it because I'm extremely fond of animals and look at insects with hate and loathing and watch them and study them and am persecuted by them. And I have seen it. You, if you've ever been exposed enough, you get a mosquito in your room. It comes humming around your head and you make a wild swipe at it, miss it, of course, and it goes away. And it doesn't come back till perhaps the next night. It's a stupid, cowardly mosquito. You get another mosquito that buzzes around. He's not going to take no for an answer. He will get you. It doesn't make the least bit of difference. And you'll never get him. And you see this kind of intelligence. You can see it in flies. You can see it. Naturalists have observed it in ants and so on. We are so conceited as a species, as man, that we not only look down on our fellow men, but we also look down on animals as lacking in intelligence, when, as a matter of fact, I think they have a great deal more intelligence than we give them credit for. So why shouldn't we give people that aren't educated the credit for having sometimes an extraordinary amount of intelligence, which they have? Sometimes I think that a great deal of our thinking is how to complicate the uncomplicated. And I'm perfectly serious. I see it in the administration. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. I'm not telling you that I'm an example in any way. I'm only talking out loud with you. But I personally have never been able to understand why the Baha'i administration seems to be so frightfully complicated. You hear Baha'is on the subject of the administration, you'd believe that we were the whole United Nations and all of its departments. But it doesn't seem to me it's that complicated. Fundamentally, it's a beautifully simple thing that Baha'u'llah thought out. Why is everything so complicated? Why do we constantly complicate things? Surely genius is simplification, not complication. So if the Baha'is, who have the advantages of an education and higher professions and higher knowledge and everything, if they want to put that to use, then why don't they try and see things in a simplified way instead of an even more complicated way than before? One of the things that I think is most... Baha'u'llah says, I had a lot of quotations here, but as I said, the light's very bad. I'm not sure I can make them out. Thou must show forth that which will ensure the peace and well-being of the miserable and the downtrodden. He doesn't say the peace and well-being of high government officials and university professors. He says the peace and well-being of the miserable and the downtrodden. I don't want to take up too much time on this subject. I think that you got whatever point I was trying to convey, I'm sure, has been conveyed. I'd like to share one or two thoughts that I have, because, as I say, all of you are an active group of people that are teaching and giving talks and attending meetings and on Baha'i committees and assemblies and counselors and board members and everything else. There's something that bothers me very, very much, and I just would like to call it to your attention. You know, the purpose of speech is to be heard. Now, if anybody can defeat that argument, I'd like to know how. We developed speech in order to express our thoughts, obviously, but having gotten vocal, then surely the whole point of speech is to be heard. But do you realize how little we teach this at any occasion in the Baha'i faith? I have heard more abominable presentations of everything in Baha'i meetings by people who get up and swallow the end of their sentences, mumble in their beards, read a prayer so that I, who am sitting here, can't hear what this person is reading into their mustache or into their shirt or whatever it is they're aiming at. But they're certainly not trying to get it over to the people present in the room, whereas the purpose of speech is to be heard, and the purpose of the prayer is that I should be able to enjoy it. There's another thing, for what it's worth, that I'd like to call attention to, and that is that people are increasingly singing Baha'i prayers. Well, everything's sung. You buy a Chevrolet, you buy a hair blower, you buy, Mazzo oil. It's all sung. There it is on the TV. You see, that's the way we market everything in the whole world today, including now the Baha'i faith. All right, I don't mind that. Perhaps this is a period in which we have to do it, so let's go ahead and do it with as much grace and dignity as we can. And fundamentally, I have no objection to a Baha'i getting up, for instance, and reciting a prayer and very softly playing a guitar or something underneath it. And I've heard it on a number of occasions recently, and it was really fundamentally dignified and beautiful. So that was all right with me. But do you think I could make out one single word of what they were saying? I mean, surely the point of a prayer is that you should address God. Not a mumbo-jumbo, then sing to me a recipe for muffins or something. Doesn't matter what you sing if I can't understand a word of it anyway, you see. So if you're going to sing a Baha'i prayer, let's leave the song part out because there's more latitude in that sort of thing. But if you're going to recite to song a Baha'i prayer, at least make it so that I can understand it, because the purpose of the prayer in a meeting is that I should also be able to address God through that prayer. I'm supposed to be creating an atmosphere, a prayer in the room. What do we have the prayers for? Do you think God cares whether we have them or not? They're important for us. They're for our well-being. So make our prayers of whatever the nature is, reciting them, playing them to music, make it in such a way that the people present can understand. And I think also that applies to the majority of the people. Increasingly, where I'm traveling around, I go to Baha'i meetings, and we have conferences, for instance, and I assure you, say it's Haiti, national language is French, they can barely understand French anyway because they speak a Creole, which is almost unintelligible, even if you know French. So anyway, they have some prayers, and no human being can understand what it is that they are saying. But all right, that's bad enough. But then along comes a prayer,